All right. Well, happy to be here with you. And it's always tough to be the last speaker in the afternoon, but I figured since I'm talking about money, you'd have good interest in staying, right? Because we've heard about a lot of good ideas, but it's hard to implement these if we don't have some funding to do it. So fortunately, there is more money coming, and not maybe as much as we need to accomplish everything we want to, but at least enough to get started with some things. And I'll also be talking about some of the existing sources of funding, some of which you're probably aware of, but maybe some others which you haven't necessarily thought of in the context of getting funding for cover crops or particularly for breeding. So I particularly wanted to cover a few particular areas that we could get funding. One is that several of us that are in the room have been working on a new national consortium for cover crops and soil health. So I'll be telling you a little bit more about that. This is going to be a $25 million effort that will provide a variety of funding in the cover crop and soil health area. I particularly work with the USDA Sustainable Ag Research and Education Program. My primary appointment is as an agronomist at University of Missouri. But if you're familiar with SARE, unlike most government programs that have federal employees running them, it's largely run by university employees. So I serve as a regional director for SARE with extension funding and out of the North Central region. I'll also take a little bit of a look at some other government funding sources. Again, some of these you'd be familiar with, but maybe not all of them. And then look a little bit creatively at some other places to get funding to support cover crops. So my talk will be a little bit beyond just breeding, but all of this funding certainly would relate to doing breeding. So a few of you in the room were at a national conference that we had about a year and a half ago in Omaha that was the first national conference on cover crops and soil health. And I mention this because a big thing that was done at this conference was to ask, how do we get to having 20 million acres of cover crops in the U.S. by the year 2020? What are the barriers that we have to overcome, and what are the actions we have to take? And not surprisingly, there were a lot of things identified, but breeding new varieties was certainly one of them, and getting more funding resources for research and education. So we had a group that followed up after the conference, a national working group on cover crops and soil health that I co-chaired, and that group took a lot of these ideas, not only from the 300 people that were in Omaha, but we had 6,000 participants, mostly farmers across the country, that fed in ideas, participating in live streaming. And we've taken those ideas and put out a set of recommendations last summer. And I'll be talking a little bit about those. So one of those recommendations was to have a new national consortium that could bring together a lot of efforts and focus some new funding on this area of cover crops and soil health. And I'll talk to you about some of the specifics of this, but the broad goal is to catalyze adoption of cover crops, no-till, and other soil health practices in the American heartland and beyond using a systems-based research and education approach. So I think you heard Stephen talking about how a systems-based approach can help us in thinking about breeding. This $25 million consortium will have a variety of components. I'm not going to go in depth on all of them due to time. Some of these will be national in nature, including education and outreach, policy work, a cover crop cultivar development effort, which I'll talk more about, two more national conferences. There'll be one in November of 2017. And then a follow-up one in 2020. Certainly partnerships with a number of national organizations. And then there will be some more regionally focused work, primarily on the Mississippi River Basin and the Great Lakes Basin. And that's where a lot of the adoption effort from this particular funding will be focused, given some of the concerns in those areas, such as with Gulf hypoxia, Lake Erie phosphorus, and so on. So just to touch on what are some of the components of this $25 million consortium. Well, there'll be some centers of excellence, one that's primarily focused on research, one that's primarily education and outreach oriented, and one that's more focused on policy and adoption issues. They will be working closely together. Each of these centers is going to be a network of multiple organizations. So for example, Iowa State University will be leading the research center, but there'll be about a half a dozen organizations working with them, both other universities and nonprofits. The National Network for Cover Crop Cultivar Improvement was something that we've been talking about for a year and a half. How do we catalyze more action, as the other speakers today have talked about? And the idea is to bring together a lot of the people that like are here in this room, work like Stephen is doing, and put that to use to get us to where we need to go with some new cultivars. There's also a piece of this consortium that's focused on multi-state teams in terms of providing grant funding. I'm going to come back and talk about that in more detail, and some targeted research projects. And ultimately, the goal of this, like most of our efforts, is to drive farmer adoption of these practices. So I know this session is on germplasm, so I wanted to talk a little bit about the cover crop cultivar improvement network. This is just a very general diagram, and it fits with much of what you already heard this afternoon. But as Stephen pointed out, the plant material centers are a really good resource with NRCS to help us scale up seed, provide sites for testing in diverse locations across the country. Obviously, we all know within the germplasm system, there's a lot of great resources there to tap. So the idea here is to bring together a lot of these different components, much as Stephen and his group are doing with the legumes, and replicate that with some other areas of cover crops, including some of the cereal grasses and some of the non-legume broadleaves, such as the brassicas. So the Samuel Roberts Noble Foundation will be a key player in this with their strong forage breeding team, and you heard a little bit about that earlier this afternoon. But anyway, that would be a effort that will be part of this consortium funded at about $2.1 million. There will also, as I said, be some competitive grants. There'll be two different grant competitions, and those will have calls released for the initial round of funding probably by mid-2016. One of those two grant competitions will be what we're calling grants on ecosystem service projects. These would be grants that would be longer-term projects of 4 to 5 years in length, each of about $1 million. I'll come back and talk more about those in a second. We'll also have some targeted research grants that will be anywhere from 2 to 4 years in nature, and these would be a little bit smaller at $500,000. All of these, of course, would go through peer review. And these grants will be awarded through a new USDA foundation called the Foundation for Food and Ag Research. Now, I do need to stop at this point and say, I don't want to say that this is a definite done deal. It's about 99% done. FFAR, their board, is in the process of making a final decision on their part of the funding, but all indications are that they will move ahead with this. But I can't stand here and say that it's completely finalized yet. So this new USDA foundation will be putting in $12.5 million if they provide their final approval, which we're expecting. And the other $12.5 million will come from the Howard G. Buffett Foundation is the plan. The multi-state research ecosystem service grants, we're tentatively targeting these at areas such as nitrogen, phosphorus, carbon, erosion, and wildlife. Those could be changed a little bit, but that's kind of the general goal. So for example, there would be a multi-state team looking at how cover crops contribute to things like wildlife, pollinators, and so on. And then these $500,000 projects will be more targeted to particular outcome-based goals. So, you know, how do we improve mycorrhiza in the soil? Are there particular cover crop species we haven't thought about or that we can be using to do that? You know, where do we get good economic returns out of using cover crops with cattle grazing or other types of grazing? How do we do that effectively? So some very targeted projects that would be typically about $500,000 in this area. Again, ultimately the goal is to drive adoption. So there'll be a component of this aimed at proving the economics of cover crops and soil health, making sure the ag industry is engaged. This is a new cover crop interseeder some of you may have seen by Hagee Equipment. So can our ag retailers that are normally spraying herbicides and fertilizers be out there seeding cover crops? That's a question we have yet to determine. Can we make sure this technology is really ready to adopt? Stephen, I think you had a very good point that a lot of times farmers are throwing this stuff out there and maybe the management is not quite what we're looking for yet. And make sure that we're doing it in a solid, farm-tested, guidance-based approach. And do education training to make sure that we have the appropriate approaches and reach the landowners. We know that's a challenge so that they know about it. And this program will have a policy component. We'll be looking at things like crop insurance to make sure that it's not a barrier to cover crops and maybe helps provide incentives to the use of cover crops and soil health. So that's a very quick snapshot of what will be a $25 million program if we get final approval, which as I said is looking pretty good right now, and I hope that will be able to be announced here in the next month or two. So I wanted to switch gears to some other funding sources besides this consortium. So, and before I leave that, I didn't specifically say the grant part of that would be $11 million, and all of you in this room would be eligible for those grants. Also, the cover crop breeding piece, which is smaller at $2 million, will have some components of that to do on-farm locations, or I should say farm test-based locations across the country. So those could be private or public farms. So we'll have out more details on that later this winter. So switching gears to other funding sources. So SARE, the program I work with, is not only a grant program, but also an outreach program. And we try to promote innovations in sustainable ag to the whole of American ag. Now, you probably have heard about SARE's grants, but you may not know that we're also very strong on outreach. We actually have seven full-time communication and outreach people that have led to a large number of not only publications, but videos and other resources. That Managing Cover Crops Profitably book up there, you may have seen that. That's been sold 40,000 hard print copies, and more than that have been downloaded for free from the web. So these resources are an important piece of getting out the message. SARE does fund a wide variety of projects. Sometimes I run into people that say, well, SARE, isn't that just organic agriculture? And, you know, that's probably 10% of our portfolio. We do things on energy, certainly grazing, nutrient management, crop diversification, you name it. So pretty wide portfolio. But we do a lot on cover crops. We have funded, I think, over 600 projects on cover crops. And by the way, that information is all online. If you get into our database, you can access those project reports from those hundreds of projects. If you're not real familiar with SARE, we operate through four regions of the U.S. Each region has a slightly different set of grant programs. I'm going to talk about the North Central region just as an example. So we have six different grant programs, and there would be an equivalent number in each of our other regions. Our overall budget's $23 million, so each region has about $5.5 million after USDA takes some money off the top. So our research and education grant program is our largest program. It's up to $200,000. These can be for grants that are just research, just education, or more typically are both. Each region awards about 8 to 10 of these a year. The maximum dollar amount does vary a little bit by region, but it's in that ballpark. And these are projects that can be up to 3 years. So again, we've funded a lot of cover crop projects out of that. Now, 3 years is not very good for doing breeding, so that's a challenge, but certainly for doing variety evaluation or related activities can be appropriate. You may not be aware that we do have a graduate student grant program. It's slightly different in each region. In the North Central region, we give grants of $10,000. Again, these can be up to 3 years. And we ask that the graduate students write these proposals. They are typically submitted through a faculty member, but it's a chance for them to get some experience writing a grant and carrying out the work, doing the reporting, and so on. And this can be in support of their thesis, or it could be a separate project that kind of adds on or complements their thesis activities. You're probably aware we have a farmer program, a farmer rancher grant program, and the reason I'm mentioning this is we often find that researchers are involved in these projects. In fact, a farmer can pay you money as a consultant or pay some of the expenses that you might have to do testing of soils or other things associated with their project, or to buy seed to do variety testing on farm. So we do a lot of these nationwide. Up to about 200 a year are funded. So there's a lot of these going on across the country. We also have in each region a professional development grant program. These are typically about $75,000. In the North Central region, there's six or seven. So again, just multiply that times four nationally. The focus on these is train the trainers. So the idea is that we're not directly using this particular set of money to educate producers, it's to educate other educators. It could be extension staff, it could be NRCS personnel, it could be VOTEC ag teachers, nonprofit educators. So they can come to a workshop or a field program or a webinar to learn more about a particular topic area, such as what is the latest with new cover crop varieties. And then a newer thing we have in each of our regions, and this one does vary a bit from region to region in terms of name and dollar amount, but is something where we're trying to team up farmers working together with an ag professional. So in this case, any of you in this room could be an ag professional working with a team of three or more farmers and could get a grant of up to $30,000. These are fairly simple grants to apply for. We just started this 2 years ago in the North Central region, and we'll fund typically 10 or 12 of these a year. So this can be a great one to do on-farm testing of new varieties or other aspects of cover crops and soil health. So those are some SARE opportunities, just to talk to you about that $23 million in funding. And again, administered through four regions. Now, I think most of you are familiar with the USDA AFRI program through NEPA. That's the largest of NEPA's grant programs. I think it's around $360 million now. If you're familiar with it, you know there's not really anything within it that's dedicated to cover crops and soil health. So we're working on that. We are actually trying to convince the leadership there to put $20 million of their $360 million into cover crops and soil health. So we'll see if that happens. But I don't think it's going to be this year. It might take a year or two for that to happen. It was mentioned earlier that there is within the ARS a variety of programs. You may have heard of the Long-Term Agroecosystem or Agroecological Research Program, LTARs. This is a program that's been around for a little while, but recently ARS started to put quite a bit more money into this. So I think there's about 18 locations nationwide, does that sound right? And some of those have been given $1 million or more per year to do that work. Now they're not taking that $1 million and doing grants, but they are working with collaborators and providing cost with equipment and expenses associated with field testing and so on. So just be aware of that one. They are trying to get cover crops at many of those LTAR locations. Okay, what about NRCS? Stephen did a good job talking about the plant material centers, but there's also a lot of other things we can do with NRCS. I'm going to come back to that, some funding there. I also wanted to mention EPA. I've been spending some time over the last couple of years talking with the EPA water quality leadership. They are really interested in getting more projects around water quality involving cover crops. And these can be pretty sizable projects. They can be multi-million dollar projects. Now, typically, they're oriented towards changing practices on the ground that are going to help with water quality issues. So they're not going to fund straight research out of this 319, but there could be a research component of a larger project aimed at adoption efforts. Soil water conservation districts are increasingly funding work around cover crops. I'll give you an example of that here in a bit. And then don't forget some of our state agencies. We're finding in a number of Midwest states that either our departments of ag or our DNR agencies are starting to fund more work around cover crops and soil health. So be sure to look at those. And likewise, some of our commodity checkoff funds. If you haven't paid much attention to commodity checkoff, I would tell you that in a lot of our bigger ag states, they have, if you're talking about a soybean association, $1 million or more a year to spend on projects. Now, that doesn't all go to research. It depends on the state. Some states prioritize that to marketing, but many do put a lot of that into research. So I would encourage you to talk to your state commodity association about the opportunity to do work on cover crops and soil health, because many of them are starting to do that. And then don't ignore private foundations. I mentioned that the Buffett Foundation is playing a major role with this new consortium, but there are a lot of other foundations out there, Walton Family Foundation, McKnight Foundation, many others that are looking at trying to provide some funding in this area. And then industry increasingly is putting some resources into this, and they're looking for partners they can do work with. So I can't say too much about it, but I know of a couple of large companies that have been thinking about doing some large-scale, multi-state trials with research on cover crops. And so there is a great opportunity for people to partner with some of these companies around this area. So I want to come back and talk just a little bit more about some of the USDA grant programs. And first of all, with AFRI, the thing I would encourage you to do if you're looking at AFRI is to kind of look for, as Stephen did creatively with the organic program, where can kind of cover crops and soil health fit into that? So, for example, there's a program they have within AFRI around kind of the prosperity of small and medium-sized farms. They probably, I haven't read this year's RFP, I don't think it's out yet, but they don't always say a lot about cover crops and that. In fact, they probably don't say anything about it. But yet that is a program that definitely can fund projects on cover crops. Stephen already mentioned the Organic Research and Extension Initiative. Those projects vary from a cap of $500,000 to up to $2 million, depending on the type of project you have. As I briefly mentioned, this national working group has proposed to USDA that they start a new, what we're calling a mini cap program around cover crops and soil health, up to $20 million. That would be projects that would provide 8 to 10 regional projects of about $2 to $2.5 million each. So I can tell you that the leadership for research at USDA was receptive to this idea, but if it happened, I think the earliest we would see it would be fiscal year 2017. So that would mean grants that probably wouldn't happen until 2018 in the calendar year. So, all right, what about NRCS? So we've heard a little bit about the plant material centers. Conservation Innovation Grants. If you haven't paid attention to these, this is a pretty large grant program, and it can be pretty research-oriented. So these grants typically, depending on the year, can be up to $1 million. The majority of them are less than that, but they each year have done a few in that size range. There's also a state component to it. Now, each state has the decision whether they want to participate or not in offering a conservation innovation grants, but many of them are. And the state ones are smaller, like in my state, Missouri, they're typically a cap of $50,000. But that is a really good program to do cover crop and soil health work. So I would encourage you to look at that grant program, the conservation innovation grants. The big kicker is that it requires a one-to-one non-federal match. So that's a high hurdle, I know, for a lot of people. And you may have to get creative working with soil and water conservation districts or commodity groups to raise that match. But it can be done. If we look at money that can go directly to farmers and kind of help us get some of this work out there, EQIP is really intended, you know, to provide cost share payments or incentive payments to farmers, as is the Conservation Stewardship Program. And then there's a new one, the Rural Conservation Partnership Program, that just started a little over a year ago. That program is a big one. So as an example, in Missouri, our State Department of Ag applied to get $5 million to provide incentives to farmers to grow cover crops. Now in their case, they applied just to do cost share payments, but the way that program is set up is it could include an education component. Research would probably be a little bit more of a stretch, but there's certainly opportunities for universities or agencies to work with each other to apply to these rural conservation partnership programs. And then the other thing I've mentioned with EQIP and some of these others is there are opportunities to do larger scale projects than just an individual farmer. So don't ignore these types of opportunities through NRCS. And then finally, NRCS periodically does have special initiatives. If you're in the middle part of the country, you probably heard they have a Mississippi River Basin Initiative, and this is a big one. They're putting over $100 million into this. Again, much of it on cost share, but if there's always opportunity to work with these groups up front to build in research and education components. So just the last couple things I wanted to hit. Don't be afraid to think creatively. This is a soil water conservation district effort. These states groups have some funds of their own, and they decided to fund an educational trailer around soil health. So it's got a lot of different messaging, kind of a built-in video screen there. Just as an example, there may be different ways to do things creatively with some non-traditional funding sources. So I will stop there, but again, lots of different funding opportunities out there if you look creatively and work to partner with other folks. So thanks.
Great. Thanks, Bob. So we have plenty of time for questions for Rob, and then hopefully that will evolve into a broader discussion amongst all the presenters and folks in the room. Questions for Rob?
Yes. Like with the SARE program, you mean?
SARE or AFRI?
Uh-huh. So SARE, fortunately, we cap our indirect at 10%. And there's actually another aspect of the regional program which sometimes come up. Since we give out our money through four regions, if you're in Auburn and you want to work with somebody in Iowa, you might, well, where do I apply? Because there's two different regions. you apply for whichever region the majority of the money is going to be spent in. So if it's about 50-50, you could apply to either region. It's your choice. But the other thing with our indirect is, again, like I said, it's capped at 10%. But you're right, it can add up in a hurry if you have a lot of institutions involved. Yes?
I have a general question for both of you.
Uh-huh.
On the tip side, the U.S. map in the middle of your presentation, on the participant in your grant, I didn't see anybody from Central Red Flag, like Western Kansas, Western Nebraska, Eastern Colorado. Now, the general impression of what I have heard from my colleagues, I'm a graduate, I don't really, I'm not an expert, but what they feel very negatively about permaculture in our my area. I just want to throw that question or comment, what you guys think about that. And I don't really buy it, because I think the issue is the management of misconception, what you call lack of knowledge, only right type of varieties. They don't have that. Whatever is available, the commercially area, available varieties, they are not appropriate for that area with high PET. So I don't know whether what is your comment, but I would be very interested to taste some material, maybe new material, what is coming from other cover crop breeders. I am not interested to breed cover crop per se, but I am willing to taste that outside. And I am interested in viewers to make us that cross.
So, Stephen, I'll start and then you can add to that. So, Stephen's effort in many ways is parallel to what was planned with this national consortium and the cover crop breeding effort within that. And so, not surprisingly, we've agreed to team up and to try to synergize the efforts. So I think where there's some gaps for the legume testing, such as maybe the High Plains, that we'll have some funding through this consortium to provide funds to test varieties at those locations, not just the legumes, but some of the other materials, such as the brassicas and so on. So we actually, I didn't say anything about this, but we have some money to have a planning meeting this winter. So if any of you are interested, I'll put out my card. We will pay your travel to come to a planning meeting on what needs to be done to really develop a good network for breeding and testing these different cover crop cultivars. I know Stephen will be involved with that. And that will probably be in late January or sometime in February. And like I said, that's something we would love to have your participation in. So Stephen, you want to add anything to that?
I guess the only thing I would add to that, say, is, you know, part of the structure of our team and how we dispersed across the country, obviously the big part of the dispersion was where plant material centers are housed. And there's a lot of intention historically about these locations. Obviously, those locations were not necessarily selected for running a cover crop breeding program. They were selected to meet, you know, very specific ecotypes and services needed by folks across the country. So we have no opposition of these kinds of partnerships. We're excited. I mean, that's kind of the nature of our project, is to build those types of partnerships and to work with folks. So we'd be eager to do that. I do know that there is a number of scientists in your area that are working heavily on cover crops. So maybe while you're hearing a lot of negative feedback by folks in those regions, as much negative feedback as you're hearing, I know that there is a lot of players in all across that region that are trying to push and work on cover.
You know, our center, the Canada Research and Assistance Center and USDAIS and ACTRA, they work together. And recently they have published a couple of papers in the Journal of Cover Crop. The take home message, cover crop did use water, which impacted the following wheat crop even negatively. So economically, it doesn't make sense. My personal argument for the water cover crop mixture they have used in the study probably is not well adapted in that area. But Manhattan and Akron is quite different. But I would be very interested, but I strongly feel there is a severe need of winter hardy, fault planted legume cover crop.
But your other point on water is certainly a big concern. And I mean, that's something that we need to do a better job of. I'm working with a group in our region who recently got a state grant to address that issue where, as he was mentioning, state is, well, you don't really do a lot of research per se through state.
One of the things they're really interested in seeing done is improving or validating, calibrating their existing models. And so we're working with process-based models and to calibrate and validate them and then refine the work they were doing to estimate water use and uptake over the course of with and without cover crops. And so, you know, while there is a general feeling, you know, obviously in a lot of these drier locations that water, that cover crops represent a net deficit, that's certainly the case in many locations in the country, but having cover crops as a surface mulch over the surface of the soil does result in a lot of water retention and increased water infiltration. So defining where you result in that net deficit and net benefit is going to be critical moving forward, because right now I think a lot of us are just looking at planting what's going on. And we know summer droughts are a big part of what drives yields, and so we need to be looking at that.
Okay, I'll get down and let you lead the final discussion.
So we have about 12 or so minutes left in the session, so we can just open this up for folks for discussion. Most of the speakers in the room, so feel free to interject on any points in the back, Sandra. Anybody have something they want to interject on?